Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Good evening. We begin with breaking news in the January 6th criminal investigation, what the attorney general himself just called the widest ranging probe in Justice Department history. And based on the breaking news, potentially the highest reaching probe as well. There's new reporting in The Washington Post this evening citing four people familiar with the investigation. The headline, Justice Department investigating Trump's actions in January 6th criminal probe. Quoting from one passage, the prosecutors have asked hours of detailed questions about meetings Trump led in December 2020 and January 2021, his pressure campaign on Pence to overturn the election, and what instructions Trump gave his lawyers and advisors about fake electors and sending electors back to the states. Again, this story breaks on the same day the attorney general speaks out, and as the former president returned to Washington for the first time since leaving office. Some of what he said shortly. First, what Merrick Garland told NBC News' Lester Holt when asked whether indicting a former president and possible presidential candidate again might tear the country apart.
We pursue justice without fear or favor. We intend to hold everyone, anyone who was criminally responsible for the events surrounding January 6th, for any attempt to interfere with the lawful transfer of power from one administration to another, accountable. That's what we do. We don't pay any attention to other issues with respect to that.
So if Donald Trump were to become a candidate for president again, that would not change your schedule or how you move forward or don't move forward?
Say again that we will hold accountable anyone who is criminally responsible for attempting to interfere with the transfer, legitimate, lawful transfer of power from one administration to the next.
As you see, during the interview, the attorney general vowed twice to hold accountable anyone who interfered with the lawful transfer of power, suggesting that the probe could be looking at a broader number of suspects. Joining us now is Josh Dawsey, who shares a byline on the Washington Post story. So CNN had some similar reporting earlier today, Josh, but your article goes a level deeper, narrowing in on the former president's actions with details about specific questions being asked by grand jury investigators, as well as phone records being seized. What more can you tell us?
So two of the main things that we know, Anderson, is that in the grand jury that's going on here in Washington, federal prosecutors have been presenting information and evidence about what former President Trump was doing in the weeks leading up to January 6th, who he was meeting with, what lawyers he had around him, what he was saying to Vice President Pence, what he was saying to Vice President Pence's aides. And they've been questioning witnesses in detail about Trump's activities, which show us that they are looking at the former president and his behavior, his conduct. I mean, we don't know how that will end, but they certainly are deeply interested in what he was doing. We also knew that a few months ago, they subpoenaed phone records for a number of top Trump aides, including his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, in another part of this investigation. So what we've really seen happening here, Anderson, is that you have prosecutors who at first were looking more at rioters in the Capitol, were looking at, you know, some of these militant groups, some of these fringe groups, some of these outside folks. And they're really homing in now more on what the former president and his lawyers did in the days leading up to January 6th.
You're reporting talks about two specific tracks the investigation is looking into.
So they're really trying to figure out on the fake elector scheme and whether the former president instructed his lawyers to kind of carry out that scheme, what his role was in that. And then obviously obstructing, you know, a government proceeding at the Capitol on January 6th. But what they're trying to figure out in a lot of these elements, Anderson, is just what exactly was a former president's role? Did you have these lawyers like John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani and these other outside advisors doing some of this on their own volition, or was the former president intimately involved? And in those days leading up to January 6th, the former president was orchestrating all sorts of pressure on Vice President Mike Pence, obviously, to overturn the election. And in recent days, the grand jury has focused on those pressure campaigns, asking this. They brought in two of former Vice President Pence's top aides, his chief of staff and his chief lawyer, and spent multiple hours with them both trying to understand all the aspects of that pressure campaign.
And in terms of timeline, do you know how fast this investigation is moving? Is it possible the former president could be subpoenaed himself? Would that actually take place?
Well, it's certainly possible that they could subpoena folks in the former president's orbit. They could try to get records from him. They could try to get phones from him. Obviously, there could be some challenges there. We don't know how fast this is moving. By some accounts, it has appeared publicly that DOJ has been behind the January 6th committee on parts of this, at least. There were multiple reports that they were surprised at some of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, for example, and they focused more on some of the outside, the rioters and more militant figures. But it seems like, just from what we know publicly in our sourcing, that now that they've gotten a little bit more evidence, they're coming in closer to the former president in this circle.
Josh Dossier, appreciate it. Thanks so much. Joining us now, CNN legal analyst and former federal prosecutor Jennifer Rogers, also CNN anchor Chris Wallace. Jennifer, first of all, the idea, you and I were talking about this before, it's unlikely they would subpoena the former president if he is a target.
For testimony, that's right. I mean, they could try to get documents or devices, as Josh just said, but they won't subpoena him for testimony because he is a target for two reasons. One, you just don't subpoena a target. But two, he's just going to plead the fifth, right, because he knows that he's their target. And so then you just have this dance where they would have to give him immunity in order to force him to testify. And obviously, they're not going to do that.
So what do you make of The Washington Post reporting tonight about where the Department of Justice is so far?
Well, I think it's really notable that they have shifted their attention to this Pence pressure campaign, because that's one area where we know the president was directly involved. He was really the prime mover in trying to force Pence to do this for him. And so that means that they're focusing in on Trump and his conduct, as opposed to some of the people around him who are the ones operationally who are actually running the fake elector scheme, for example.
And Chris, I mean, to Jennifer's point, the prosecutors in this case focusing on the former president's pressure campaign. Garland sort of made a nod to that as well today.
Yeah, it seems to me, Anderson, that one, and most importantly, that the Justice Department seems to be on the case, but secondly, that they want to be seen as being on the case, because there's been a lot of pressure on Garland and Justice, that they seem to be lagging behind the January 6th committee. They seem to be lagging behind that DA in Atlanta who's pursuing her own case about Georgia and interference with the election there. So, I mean, you had a couple of things. On Monday, we found out that they had a grand jury, had heard testimony from two top aides to Mike Pence, Mark Short, his chief of staff, and Greg Jacob, his counsel. You had the attorney general agreeing to do the interview today. And twice in the interview, he said, we're moving urgently. And one other thing I noted in Josh Dawsey's story in The Washington Post that is breaking tonight, that it specifically says that they seized the records of Mark Meadows, phone records of Rip Meadows and other people, and specifically said they did it in April, months before the January 6th committee. So clearly somebody at Justice from Merrick Garland on down is trying to say, we are hot on this case. Don't think that we're lagging behind.
And Jennifer, on the other track, the phony electors, obviously the question of how involved was the former president in that? Was it his attorney Eastman and Rudy Giuliani going off and doing this, largely on their own? How much are they able to get the records of Giuliani, records of Eastman?
So it's really hard to know from just phone records who's talking to whom for how much time, what was said. I mean, in order to get to how much the former president knew about that scheme and how much he was directing it as opposed to just being updated on it, they're really going to have to get someone who was dealing directly with him to testify. Mm. So that probably means giving one of these people immunity ultimately so that they can talk about the conversations where Trump was being updated, or maybe he was actually running the show. We don't know. We know he knew about the scheme, but we don't know how how involved
things like attorney-client privilege. I mean, how does that play in with the Department of Justice with somebody like Eastman?
So to the extent that they're seizing documents that might have communications with Trump, to the extent that they're going to seek testimony that involves communications, they're going to have to sort through that. I mean, there's a crime fraud exception. So if the communication is for the purpose of furthering a crime or a fraud, which DOJ would argue it was, then they can see that material. But all of that takes time and takes a judge to rule on whether it was or it wasn't. So you have to get through all those privilege issues.
Chris, I want to play more of what the attorney general said tonight when he was asked about the criticism that the DOJ isn't moving quickly enough.
The reason there is this speculation and uncertainty is that a fundamental tenet of what we do as prosecutors and investigators is to do it outside of the public eye. We do that for two important reasons. One is to protect the civil liberties of people and events that we're investigating, and the second is to ensure the success and the integrity of our investigation.
It's interesting, Chris, you know, what the attorney general not only is trying to convey to the general public, but maybe to the January 6th committee specifically.
Yeah, clearly he is feeling some heat and they're trying to say, I mean, he says we're doing it outside of the eye of the public, but there have been a lot of leaks of information, just what we've heard about who was testifying before the grand jury, like Mark Short, the story in The Washington Post tonight. They're trying to, on the one hand, they're saying we're doing this outside the public, but on the other hand, we're also going to give some information to the public to try to get the heat off us. He was also asked, Merrick Garland, by Lester Holt of that NBC interview about the fact that, you know, how much are you getting information from the January 6th committee? And he said, look, they're doing the biggest investigation in one of the biggest in House history. We're doing the biggest investigation in Justice Department history, and we may have some information they don't have, and they may have some information we don't have, and we're hoping to hoover all of that up. You know, having said all of that, Anderson, one of the articles I was reading today made the point, no former president in our history has ever been charged with a crime. So even what, regardless of whatever information they get out, and there's a lot of evidence that Trump was directly involved. Remember, in the hearings, we heard that he told one of the people of the Justice Department, just say that there was a problem with the election and leave the rest to me and Republican congressmen. So there are a lot of people who will say Trump was directly involved. But going ahead and charging a former president with a crime is absolutely uncharted territory.
Yeah. Jennifer, not only a former president who may, by the time this comes around, be actually running again.
Yeah, I mean, that's a political issue, and certainly the timing of elections is something that DOJ pays attention to, but it's not technically a bar. I mean, they can certainly charge a political candidate with something, and Merrick Garland made pretty clear today that candidate or no, they're looking at Trump, and they'll do what needs to be done.
Jennifer Rogers, appreciate it. Chris Wallace as well. Thanks so much. Perspective now from Mick Mulvaney, who served first as acting chief of staff in the former administration, and later a special envoy for Northern Ireland. He resigned from the administration because of January 6th. Mr. Mulvaney, I'm wondering what you make of what Attorney General Garland had to say tonight. Do you think he offered any more insight into whether the Justice Department might indict the former president?
Not really. By the way, Anderson, thanks for having me. I was very, very pleased with what he said. I think most Americans would be. That chief law enforcement officer in the United States said they were going to go about things deliberately and without concern for politics. That's what I would want them to say on any particular investigation into any crime committed possibly by any person in the country. That's what we want when it comes to law enforcement. I think if there's anything that sort of gave some insight as to what's happening, though, it's not what Merrick Garland said this evening. It's the fact that Mark Short was called into a federal grand jury under subpoena on Tuesday. That tells me.
And Mr. Jacob as well.
That's correct. That tells me a lot more about what's actually happening than what you heard from Merrick Garland this evening.
The attorney general said that they were investigating the legitimate and lawful transfer of power. Mm-hmm. Did you interpret that as looking beyond just January 6th?
Yeah, I do. And I think the simple fact that the chief counsel, the chief lawyer for the vice president was called in, because we know now, because of the work the January 6th committee has done, that there were a lot of discussions with the lawyers in the period of time between the election and January 6th. So the simple fact that Mike Pence's lawyer was subpoenaed tells me that something is going a little bit deeper than just that 24-hour period around the riot itself.
Do you believe Garland when he says, look, we don't take into account anything other than, you know, we're just following the law. Shouldn't I mean, should the Justice Department take into account charging, you know, potentially charging somebody who's running for re-election if, in fact, the president decides to do that?
No. Republicans were OK. I was OK with the Department of Justice investigating Hillary Clinton when she was a candidate. If there have been crimes committed by anybody, we want the Department of Justice to investigate whether or not that has happened. We don't want law enforcement to be politically influenced one way or the other. We don't want the Supreme Court to be influenced one way or the other. Is it difficult as a nation sometimes to take the decisions of a Department of Justice or, say, even a Supreme Court? Yeah, but that's their job. They enforce the law. The court interprets the law. You want them to do that devoid of politics.
I want to ask you about former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. You held that job, obviously, as well. Given what you heard from former Trump White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson and others about his actions and inactions, do you think he may be in legal trouble here?
You know, I never practiced criminal law, so I don't want to say what I don't want to give an opinion where I'm just showing you how stupid I am. But what I will say is this, is that what I took away from Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony was that the West Wing was broken. It was not functioning properly. Having a chief of staff detached and sitting on the sofa texting essentially while Rome burns is one of those giant red flags that things were not functioning properly. In that type of setting, can people make really bad decisions that can come back to haunt them? Absolutely. Personally, I think that there's bigger risk based upon what I've seen so far for obstruction of justice after the fact. You can be as innocent as the new driven snow on January 6th, but if you try and interfere with witnesses, it's so often the cover-up, Anderson, that is a bigger deal than the underlying potential crime itself. So there were a lot of bad things happening in the West Wing, bad decisions were made. And again, when things are broken, bad things happen.
The bar obviously is higher, though, for the Department of Justice than it is for the January 6th Commission. What everyone thinks of the January 6th Commission, they are able to have people say things which in a court of law would not, hearsay, for instance, would not hold up.
That's correct. A lot of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, for example, is interesting and insightful, but it would never be allowed in court. It might be allowed in a grand jury, for example. Look, one of the questions they asked of Merrick Garland this evening was why he wasn't going faster. And he gave the exact correct answer, which is they're doing it methodically because that's their job. The January 6th committee, say what you want about it, is a political process. There's a political agenda. There are politicians involved. It's not a courtroom, and it's certainly not a criminal investigation. You want the Department of Justice to be more methodical because it's a lot more serious.
Just lastly, according to the New York Times, Jared Kushner wrote in his new book that when he was being treated for thyroid cancer in 2019, he only told four people in the White House, you being one of the four, according to a reporter, a person close to you told the New York Times, you didn't remember that. Is that accurate? Do you remember Jared Kushner telling you about that?
Yeah, that one sort of took me by surprise. I don't remember if Jared told me. I don't recall that. I will tell you this, that if anybody on the staff, including the son-in-law of the president of the United States, came to me and said, look, I have a very serious health matter, I'm telling the president that we don't get to keep secrets from the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. So I know I think in the book said that we managed to keep it a secret from the president or something like that. That would not happen. So I don't have a specific recollection, but I can assure you any chief of staff finds out that a senior person like that is ill, the president's going to know about it.
Mick Mulvaney, appreciate talking to you.
Thanks, Anderson.
Coming up next, the former president called to give back the respect he says police deserve. That and what a former officer assaulted by Trump supporters at the Capitol has to say about it. And also why the president is saying he is the most persecuted person ever in the history of this country. Also, more on the economy, teetering between high inflation and a possible recession. We'll talk to the political strategist who famously first said, "Is the economy stupid?" James Carville joins us. Tonight's reporting, The Washington Post, that the Justice Department is investigating the former president's actions with respect to January 6th comes at the end of a day that we saw the former president return to Washington and to a familiar theme, himself.
A friend of mine recently said that I was the most persecuted person in the history of our country. And then I started thinking about it, Kellyanne, and I said, you know what? He may very well be right. He may be right.
The former president said that after a long litany about crime in the streets, in which he said this.
We have to give our police back their authority, resources, power, and prestige. We have to leave our police alone. Every time they do something, they're afraid they're going to be destroyed, their pension's going to be taken away, they'll be fired, they'll be put in jail. Let them do their job. Give them back the respect that they deserve.
Now, as you might imagine, those words, which were well received by the audience, might land quite differently for many people, especially in law enforcement, in light of what they experienced on January 6th as Trump supporters violently assaulted police, including CNN law enforcement analyst and former D.C. police officer Michael Fanone, who was badly beaten, tasered, suffered a concussion and a heart attack trying to do his job on that day and subsequently experienced post-traumatic stress. Officer Fanone, thanks so much for being with us. When you hear the former president say, give police, quote, back the respect that they deserve, I'm wondering what went through your mind.
Just listening to his speech, while there's certainly elements of it that I agree with, I think he's the least credible person, perhaps the least credible president in our history to deliver any remarks purporting himself to be pro-police or, pro-law and order. He literally incited an insurrection, and that there's significant evidence now that we've seen to show that he participated in and maybe even orchestrated a seditious conspiracy.
And when the former president, I mean, he's claiming that he champions law enforcement as someone obviously who was viciously attacked by members of the Trump-inspired mob, he's calling, police, he claims he's championing law enforcement, calling police officers his heroes. Do you buy that? I mean, we've heard testimony in the January 6th Commission from people who were working with the former president who specifically have pointed out he doesn't, all that stuff about his support for law enforcement, once you see what he did on, put up with on January 6th, it just looks so hollow.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is pro-police in that he supports the police officers that vote for him, just like he's pro anyone who was willing to cast a ballot in his favor. But as far as caring about, the individual law enforcement officers, just like a lot of people in this country, he couldn't care less.
I want to play another part of what the former president said about law and order today.
And where there is a true and total breakdown of law and order, where citizens' most basic rights have been violated, then the federal government can and should send the National Guard to restore order and secure the peace without having to wait for the approval of some governor that thinks it's politically incorrect to call him in. The next president needs to send the National Guard to the most dangerous neighborhoods in Chicago until safety can be successfully restored, which can happen very, very quickly.
The former president is talking about the federal government not having to wait for a governor's approval to send in the National Guard. We just learned the former acting defense secretary told the House Select Committee that the former president never gave him a formal order to have 10,000 troops ready to be deployed to the Capitol on January 6th, like he keeps claiming he did.
Right. Yeah, I mean, first of all, we have a law in this country, posse comitatus, which prevents federal troops from entering into the states and engaging in law enforcement activity without first receiving approval and authorization from the governors. I'm an American. I don't want to live in a country where I'm policed by the military. I think that's probably one of the most un-American things that I could imagine. I get it. Crime is real bad in some of these areas, but there are a lot of other solutions rather than declaring martial law. And again, like the irony of, Donald Trump claiming that he's willing to use these resources to combat crime, but was not willing to use them to defend the police officers who were fighting to protect members of Congress and the Capitol complex.
It is particularly shameless of him on his first time back to Washington to be making this the subject of his speech. He defended insurrectionists in this speech. People who, quote, in his words, in some cases didn't even enter the building. He went on to say they are, quote, being tortured and handled so horribly. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, he sent them to the Capitol on January 6th, so he has to stick up for them. He's counting on their support I'm assuming that he's going to announce a bid for 2024 to run for president. But, you know, calling Donald Trump shameless, you know, those words ring hollow. You know, Donald Trump doesn't care about things like honor, integrity, shame. You know, those are just not words that mean anything to him. And I mean, unfortunately, they don't mean a whole lot to many of his supporters.
Officer Michael Fanone, I appreciate talking to you as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, new polling showing trouble for President Biden's possible reelection efforts, specifically from within his own party. I'll talk Democratic strategist and chief strategist for President Clinton's 1992 campaign, James Carville, next. New CNN poll today showed a dim outlook for the president in 2024. 75% of Democratic and Democratic-leaning voters want the party to nominate someone other than President Biden for the next presidential election. 75%. That number's up from 51% in a poll conducted just in January and February. According to CNN's Harry Enten, that 75% figure is the weakest numbers for an incumbent president seeking re-election since Jimmy Carter in 78. And it comes as Americans express frustration over the state of the economy, the country, inflation at a 40-year high, Americans struggling with rising costs of food, housing, gas, consumer confidence slipping for the third straight month in July. Despite these worries, President Biden said on Monday he doesn't believe the nation will see a recession. Joining me now, Democratic strategist James Carville, co-host of the Politics War Room podcast. James, you see these numbers, 75%. Is there anything the president can do to reverse these kind of numbers in his own party?
Yeah, well, if we have a decent 2022, it'll help. In my business, it's considered to be impolite to talk about the election after the next one. But, these numbers, I've seen similar numbers in other polls. And they're quite challenging, but, you know, let's see how well we can do in November of this year, and then we'll get to 2024.
You famously coined the phrase, it's the economy, stupid, during the 92 presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. I mean, index that tracks consumer confidence fell for the third month in a row. What kind of tangible argument can Democrats make to voters on the economy in this next election?
Well, let's be honest. Gas prices have fallen also pretty consistently here over the last 6-7 weeks. Hourly workers are actually having a pretty good go at it. But there's no doubt there's, you know, deep and profound troubles in this economy. But, you know, the strange thing is that contraindications that some of these Senate races, the guy the campaign called me and said, man, we're doing a lot better than I thought we'd be doing. You know, small donor stuff is just pouring in for Democrats. So,
do you think is that related to Roe v. Wade? Is it related to the idea of President Trump coming back? Right. What do you think it is?
I don't know. We're going to find out a lot a week from today in Kansas, because there's an election, an actual election, where Dobbs is more or less on the ballot. So we'll know a week from tonight exactly what it is, because in one of the deepest red states, the question of the regulation of abortion is going to be on the ballot, and people will actually vote on that. So that's something that every viewer of this network and this program should be, you know, get their popcorn out and watch these election returns Tuesday night, because they're going to be very, very significant.
If you were in the White House right now, and again, whether it's concerned about the presidential election or the midterms, what would your messaging be? What would get you up in the morning?
What would get me up in the morning is, you know, first thing I'd do is exactly what Ron Klain does, is I would check the gas prices. I would see, you know, check in with these different campaigns and to, you know, see what's going on. But, you know, the truth of the matter is there's not a lot the president can do. I mean, I sat through the 1994 cycle and we got clobbered. We got clobbered in 2010. The Republicans got clobbered in 2018. I mean, there's a lot of history going against the party in power, but, you know, you're trying to get things better. But the truth of the matter is we're actually doing better in the generic ballot test in a lot of these Senate races around the country. So that there is some sunshine coming in this, which looks like a, you know, really dark cycle.
I want to ask you about this thing that some groups that support Democrats have done, which is bought advertising, which may boost far-right candidates against more moderate Republicans, the idea that fringe candidates would be easier to defeat in a general election because they would turn off so many independents and others. Congressman Adam Kinzinger called Democratic groups helping to promote election deniers disgusting. He warned they were underestimating the threat to democracy in the U.S. I just want to play what he said and then ask you to respond.
Sure.
While I think a certain number of Democrats truly understand that democracy is threatened, don't come to me after having spent money supporting an election denier in a primary and then come to me and say, where are all the good Republicans? You're worried about democracy. I truly believe that all these issues we argue about, they matter, but the thing that matters the most right now is the threat to our democracy. It's the thing our kids will judge us by, and when we're sitting here playing DCCC, DNC politics, let's promote the crazy, and then that person wins, you don't understand the real threat. I'm sorry, you don't understand the threat to democracy.
What do you think of this strategy that some are doing?
Well, look, this has gone on forever. Rush Limbaugh told his people to vote and cross over in Democratic primaries. I've seen this happen any number of times. And sometimes, most of the times, it's ineffective. It doesn't work. But if I'm running a campaign, I'm going to do whatever I think is in the best interest of that candidate. You know, that's what they hired me to do. I would, without hesitation, equivocation, or reservation, if I thought it would help my candidate, if I promoted a candidate on the Republican side, I'd do it. I wouldn't have one iota of moral qualm about it. Now, it's not very effective. I mean, and people say, well, the Democrats wanted to run against Reagan. Okay, the Republicans were going to nominate him anyway. And they said, well, the Democrats wanted to run against Trump. We didn't have it, but they were going to nominate Trump anyway. The idea that they have the real power to do this. But in Pennsylvania, if the Josh Shapiro thing, what they did, I think was ethical, smart, and they're acting in the best interests of their candidate, their party, their supporters, and their donors. I have no problem with it.
James Carville, that's why we asked you. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. I knew you'd give your opinion.
Thank you.
All right. Best to your family. Up next, a look at next week's primary battle in Michigan, where a freshman Republican congressman who voted to impeach the former president will face off against a former Trump administration official, and a dive into how Democrats are also getting in on the race. It is 1 week before one of the most closely watched Republican primaries in the country. Michigan Republican Peter Meyer faces John Gibbs, a former official in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Meyer voted for the impeachment of the former president. Gibbs is endorsed by him. CNN Chief Congressional Correspondent Mana Raju has the story.
3 days into Congressman Peter Meyer's freshman term, pro-Trump rioters attacked the Capitol. A week after that, he voted with just 9 other alarmed Republicans to impeach Donald Trump over his role. Now he could lose his job because of that vote.
Was that a concern of yours that you got defined by this?
Yeah, I think you always have a moment where you say, I can take the easy way or I can actually follow where my conscience is. If your number one job in office is to stay in office, you should find another job.
You don't regret that vote?
Not for a second.
Despite hailing from a storied Michigan family and maintaining a conservative voting record, Republicans see Meyer as the clear underdog in next Tuesday's primary.
Oh, yeah. I think it was the biggest career-ending move in history, possibly, for him to do that.
John Gibbs is trying to unseat him. A former Trump administration housing official who has the support of the former president, Gibbs is embracing false election claims.
Do you think the election was stolen?
I do think there's enough shenanigans to change the result, yeah.
So what do you say to folks who say that kind of rhetoric is dangerous?
Don't blame messenger.
It was never proven. There was never widespread fraud. What do you say to the fact that that never really materialized?
I think one analogy that you could look at here is the mafia. For many years, you could never arrest them. You knew they were throwing guys off roofs and stuff. But I think we will get there, just like we did with the mafia.
It's that kind of rhetoric that has Democrats hoping to face Gibbs in November, with the House Democrats' campaign arm propping him up with this ad.
Handpicked by Trump to run for Congress, Gibbs called Trump the greatest president.
Part of a national strategy to boost far-right Republicans in primaries, even as they call them a threat to democracy.
I think that Gibbs has certainly fired up a certain portion of the electorate over those claims, and I think it's dangerous.
Democrats could flip the seat with a boost from redistricting.
This district is so winnable. We can do it this time.
Moving the district nearly 12 points in the Democrats' direction. But Democrat Hillary Scolden will first have to overcome President Biden's sagging approval and concerns over inflation.
Is the president helping or hurting you in this race?
You know, president isn't in this race.
Yet both Biden and his predecessor loom large.
John Gibbs.
Like the former president, Gibbs downplays the January 6th attack by the Trump-inspired mob.
Trump supporters, do you blame them? You know, who were there? Were they the ones who came into the Capitol?
I don't know, but from what I understand and the pictures that I've seen, the vast, vast majority of people there were just standing around and holding flags and things like that. So those people obviously didn't do anything wrong.
Myers, though, lived through the deadly riot of that day.
For 3 hours, the president did nothing. I think that was a shameful dereliction of duty.
And Manu Raju joins us. Now, Mr. I'm amazed some of the things Mr. Gibbs says with a straight face. We know the former president supports his opponent, John Gibbs. How does the rest of the Republican Party feel about him?
Well, they want Peter Meyer to win, even if they may not be public about it or saying, talking much about it publicly. The Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, was quietly gave through his leadership PAC $10,000 to Peter Meyer just in the last several days. The party committee on the Republican side has staying neutral on this. But what's also interesting, too, of this race, Anderson, Peter Meyer and his super PAC have spent a ton of money on the air trying to promote him. Super PAC have gone after John Gibbs. But Gibbs himself has not run a single TV ad at all on through the course of his primary, even though he is seen very clearly as a front runner. And that makes Democrats happy because not only those January 6th views and the views about the false claims about a stolen election they plan to jump on, but also his views on abortion as well, Anderson, telling me that he does not support exceptions in the cases of rape, something that Democrats undoubtedly will try to exploit in a general election.
Manu Raju, appreciate it. Thanks. Coming up, after years of waiting, families of some of those killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut are finally getting their chance to make conspiracy spreader Alex Jones pay for the lies he has peddled about the killings. The first of several trials seeking damages after being found legally responsible for his false claims began today. We'll have a live report from Austin, Texas. Next. Opening arguments began today in the first of several trials involving parents of the children murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School and conspiracy spreader Alex Jones. In October, Jones was found legally responsible for the false claims he made about the killings. Today, the lawyer for the plaintiff said they are now seeking $150 million in damages.
Now, that is a huge verdict, to be sure. But it is one that will do justice to the level of harm done in this case. Harm that was done to the grieving parents of murdered children who have had to endure for 10 years the most despicable and vile campaign of defamation and slander in American history.
Well, today, Jones's lawyers claim that thousands were questioning the shooting, not just him, all because of what he called, quote, bad coverage, unquote, by the mainstream media. The mass killing occurred 10 years ago, this December, in Newtown, Connecticut. Six adults, 20 children were murdered. Joining me now is the New York Times' Elizabeth Williamson, who has been covering the trial from Austin, Texas. She's also the author of Sandy Hook, An American Tragedy and the Battle for Truth, published earlier this year. You've been following, Elizabeth, this story and the consequences of Alex Jones's lies about the Sandy Hook shooting for years. What stood out to you in court today?
Hey, Anderson, thanks for having me on. I think what stood out to me is that this is the first time that we have heard a dollar figure attached to the suffering that these families have gone through after Alex Jones began spreading lies about Sandy Hook, that it was a government hoax in service to gun control. So this is an attempt to sort of, you know, put a material value on what they've gone through as that sort of secondary trauma after the shooting itself.
The $150 million in damages, $75 million of that represents $1 from each person who didn't believe the shooting occurred because of false information pushed by Alex Jones. That's what the lawyers are saying. I'm wondering what the reaction from Jones was when that number was said in court.
He was visibly unnerved by that. It's kind of a complicated formula that the lawyers came up with after Monday when Jones's own lawyer suggested that they might seek a single dollar in damages. And he extended this argument that the parents' loss of their son, Jesse Lewis, was so enormous that anything Jones could have said or done was just sort of paled in comparison. So this motivated the lawyers to say that for, you know, they cited a poll in which a quarter of Americans shortly after the shooting believed that Sandy Hook was either definitely or possibly faked. And so that's 750 million Americans. So they came up with a formula that would make Jones pay a dollar for the reputational damage and the emotional damage that he inflicted by convincing that many people that the shooting was faked.
I understand Alex Jones was parading around today, acting as if somehow he is a victim. And in the middle of the proceedings, actually went out and did he hold some kind of a press conference, which the judge admonished him for?
Yes, he sort of, after this $150 million amount was raised, he kind of burst out of the courtroom and began sort of holding forth just, you know, a couple dozen feet from the courtroom. The judge was really unhappy about that because jurors are in the area. So she admonished him for that. But he was enormously angry. He called this, you know, constitution-destroying move and that it was a kangaroo court and a show trial. This is something he's been saying for years, of course.
Is there any indication that Jones will actually testify?
That's an open question. You know, he was in the court today, as we've seen in other court appearances and unrelated cases. He has a hard time kind of controlling his emotions in court. Today, he was putting a piece of duct tape over his mouth saying, save the first, referring to the First Amendment, and leaving that on the table in view of the jurors. I think that, you know, maybe both sides would see this as somewhat of a risk because he's such an unpredictable character.
Can they actually get money from him? I mean, he sells a lot of ads for supplements and you know, who knows what else?
Yeah, I mean, he has a pretty ingenious business model. And when you look at the fine that's been, or the, you know, the proposed judgment, really that's equivalent to about 3 years worth of $50 million in annual revenues that,
wow,
that he has earned. Yeah, wow. Selling doomsday prepper merchandise, untraceable gun components, body armor, and diet supplements, all for people who distrust everything from traditional medicine to the federal government. And that's kind of what's at the root of this whole case.
Yeah.
So the money's probably there.
Elizabeth Williamson, I so appreciate all your reporting for years on this. Thank you. We'll be right back. Klondike could not have picked a worse time, a hotter time, to announce the end of a beloved ice cream treat. The Choco Taco, novelty ice cream sandwich in a taco-shaped cone, is no more. Fans have been upset ever since Klondike said it had to make some, quote, very tough decisions about which products to continue in order to meet demand. In a tweet last night, however, Klondike did hint at a comeback, saying they're working hard to bring the Choco Taco, quote, back to ice cream trucks in the coming years. We can only hope. The news continues. Let's hand over to Laura Coates in CNN Tonight. Laura?
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.